The Contenders is a proud member of the Cage Club Podcast Network.
For other great shows about movies and pop culture, go visit cageclub.me. That's cageclub.me.
You can't dance. When did you learn how to dance?
I've got moves you've never seen.
Oh, yes. No, absolutely.
Love to. Love the bag, love the shoes, love everything, love to.
No, I love this man, and there's no way that I'm going to give him up to some two-faced, big-haired food critic.
I did what I came to do.
What, you spit them up?
No, I said goodbye.
Welcome to The Contenders, the show about the movies made by and starring women who refuse to play by the rules. I'm Aislinn Addington.
And I'm Tobin Addington.
And I am so excited to introduce our guest this evening. I mean, dare I say, the Kimmy to my Julianne, in that he did marry who I was hoping to be my backup, Tony DeFrank.
Hello, Tony. How's that for an introduction?
That I was not expecting that. So that was tremendous. Thank you.
Tony is also an expert on the movie that we're going to be discussing tonight, in addition to being Joe Bolenbaugh's husband. That movie is My Best Friend's Wedding from 1997, a year I remember well. I don't know. I graduated from high school in 97. I don't know.
Wow.
Did I? Is that right? Oh, God. Yeah.
Yes. Wow, okay. That's what your Letterman jacket said.
That's true. It did. And still does. Aislinn, do you remember the first time you saw My Best Friend's Wedding?
I do. Thank you for asking. It had gotten a lot of, when I say buzz, it was 1997. So a lot of humans were talking about it to each other in person. And
what?
Exactly. And strangely, it was at the Wilma, which I think is an odd place for it to have been. That is a theater in Missoula, Montana. Mm-hmm.
Not generally a first run theater.
No.
Right? Yeah.
But I think in the late 90s, as we all were, they were looking for an identity.
Yeah.
And so they tried this out. But so I went with our mother, Tobin, on a Thursday night on our way to pick up dad from the airport. And it was right near the beginning of his job as a traveling consultant.
Mm-hmm.
So we were just getting used to that. And I remember thinking, we can't be late to be at the movie theater. And as I recall, mom saying, okay, just 5 more minutes and then we'll go. So we were up and standing at the back for the last scene because we really did need to go get to the airport to pick up dad. But I think we were on time. We were just cutting it closer than I was comfortable with. But that's my recollection. How about Tony? Tony, when did you first see this movie?
Okay, so I was trying to figure this out. I definitely watched it at my sister's townhouse when she was in college. My sister was in a sorority and there was this big like family function we all had to go attend, and I was sleeping on the couch and couldn't fall asleep, and I grabbed this movie that I'd obviously heard of, and you know, popped it in and was immediately obsessed with it from like the opening credits onward. So much so that I watched it twice in a row. So
oh,
I was
wow.
I was probably, let me see, 97. I was probably 15, I think. So for me, you know, just like the first time that I watched this movie through, and I just immediately connected with George, like being like a young queer kid and not really mm-hmm. having a whole lot of access to gay culture in Virginia at age, you know, 15. Yeah. I just was like, mm-hmm. oh, well, this is what my life is going to look like, right?
So, an instruction manual of how to be a gay best friend.
Yeah, yeah. So I was like, okay, so I'm just going to immediately watch it again because I really need to like get this stuff down. But that was kind of where my obsession started, was the night I watched it twice in a row.
I don't remember exactly the first time I saw it. I don't think it was in the theater. I think it was on VHS. But I know that it was sometime during college, and I watched it. I then sort of became, I don't know, obsessed is too strong a word, but I watched it a bunch. And it was on a bunch. Like, it was one that people would kind of put on a little bit as kind of background movie, I think, sometimes. And then in film school, I was sort of expanding my knowledge of film history and whatnot, and watching a lot of sort of history of like romantic comedies. And romantic comedies, you know, Iceland, we grew up in a household where romantic comedies were on frequently in our house. I was going to say,
that's just what we called movies. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. And I always found myself sort of comparing and contrasting to this movie. And I've taught this a number of times in film history classes or film studies classes when we're talking about the history of the romantic comedy genre. And I think so sort of makes and breaks the mold at the same time. I adore this movie for that and for all kinds of reasons that I can't wait to get into.
Wow. Well, that's, yeah, I've got two big fans with me here. Okay.
I smell trouble. Wait, no.
Before we dig in any further, let's get a little bit of history. Now, I do have it in my notes that Tobin will give us two bits. But Tony, if you have additional historical knowledge, please share it as well.
Absolutely.
The first bit is that a lot of people read for the role of Kimmy, the Cameron Diaz role, two of them, which makes a lot of sense. It was a Julia Roberts movie. You know, she was attached from the time the script was sold, and it was a very kind of hot movie, right? So Reese Witherspoon and Drew Barrymore apparently both read for Kimmy before they went with Cameron Diaz. And then this is one of my favorites. Julia Roberts apparently suggested Benicio del Toro to play George. Which is wild. I can hardly imagine that version of the movie. The other bit is that, speaking of George, director P.J. Hogan and writer Ron Bass greatly expanded George's role after they cast Rupert Everett and saw his chemistry with Julia Roberts. Most notoriously, the ending, which they had a different ending and then shot the movie and then went back to reshoot the ending that's in the movie. But even earlier than that, the George character had a handful of lines in the original script and didn't come to visit, didn't pretend to be her fiance. Like, there's all kinds of stuff that George does in this movie, and that includes the musical number in the middle of the movie, that all of which was sort of created, kind of inspired by Rupert Everett and his chemistry with Julia Roberts. Aislinn.
Yes.
Can you tell us, please, who the ladies in charge, the women involved in major roles in My Best Friend's Wedding?
I would love to. We have lead actors Julia Roberts and Cameron Diaz. Producers Patricia Cullen and Patricia Witcher. And editor Lisa Fruchtman.
Good work.
How did I do with that one? I didn't read that ahead of time.
Whenever I type these up, I'm like, I can't wait to hear how Aislinn goes at these. I think you did a great job. I'm so glad it's you, not me, who has to do that.
Tobin, could you give us a brief plot summary?
Sure.
I mean, although I think most of our listeners have probably seen this, let's benefit of the doubt.
I would hope most of them had seen this movie. When she learns her old flame and best friend is about to get married, 27-year-old food critic Julianne, played by Julia Roberts, agrees to come to the extravagant 4-day wedding weekend to break up the couple and claim Michael, the groom-to-be, played by Dermot Mulroney, for herself. The problem is the bride-to-be, Kimmy, played by an exceedingly chipper Cameron Diaz, is delightful, charming, and kind, and Michael seems to really love her. Many pratfalls, hijinks, and one transcendent musical number later, Julianne finally comes around to do the right thing, the graceful thing, and help the couple reunite before celebrating their marriage and sharing a last dance with her gay wingman and truth seeker George, played by a delicious Rupert Everett, in one of the greatest endings in romantic comedy history.
Wow. All right.
So say I.
I'm glad that you mentioned pratfalls in your summary, because yes. What stood out to me this time, and I've seen this movie many times, but I hadn't seen it in quite a while when I watched it yesterday mm-hmm. and a little bit today at lunch. There is a lot of physical comedy in quotes.
That is in so true. Piece. I have that note as well. I just wanted to chime in.
Please. Yes. What it reminds me of is a sad story about Sandra Bullock on the set of that movie All About Steve.
Uh-huh.
And there's a rumor that she kept wanting to insert falling down or, uh-huh. you know, like that she kept, oh, this is going to be great. I'll do this. I'll do that. And I don't know. I mean, at that point, the movie was probably already such a stinker that they're like, okay, do whatever you want to do. But I had forgotten that was maybe she saw it all in this movie and then decided that All About Steve needed some more too. But just there's nary a chair that doesn't topple over in this film.
Tony, did the physical comedy work for you in this movie?
Yeah. And you know what? This was so my best friend has a real thing for physical comedy. It's not something that usually stands out to me on my own, but because of our long-standing friendship, every time just like pratfalls and hijinks occur, I'm like, oh my God, Billy's gonna love this movie. There's so much physical comedy in it. And because this is the first time I've ever watched this beloved movie and taken pages of notes, I was like, I'm gonna have to jot this down because I don't think I've ever cataloged this as such a physical movie. Yeah, there's a lot of falling, tripping, stumbling. Yeah, it's pretty impressive.
I you know what, one of the things that I like so much about the physical comedy that Julia Roberts does is that they are going out of their way to make her not graceful. Mm. And I think in romantic comedies, that is such a, it's kind of unusual. It's not that she's clumsy so much as the first time that she has real physical comedy is when she falls off the bed when she's talking to Michael on the phone and discovers that he's not calling because, as per their pact, they're going to now get married before they turn 28 as each other's backup. But in fact, he's met somebody else and is going to get married. She falls off the bed. So it's kind of like her center of gravity is completely off then for the rest of the movie. And she's, you know, and to the point that by the end, there's no pratfall at the end in her dance, right? Like once she has recentered herself and sort of gotten her priorities straight and stopped being so cruel, she kind of finds equilibrium and then that stuff kind of stops. So it's a great way of sort of, I think, physicalizing that stuff. And then also, as I sense from your tone, you don't think it's very funny. I think it's hysterical.
I think some of it is funny. I think I was overwhelmed by the amount. I had remembered the falling off the bed. What I had forgotten is, for instance, when she's writing the email in the boss's office and she's looking through the crack in the door that she fell. And there was something in between those two that I had forgotten as well. But I had also remembered that she was meant to be somewhat clumsy, because when she's holding all the beer on the tray and he says, do you want help? And I so remember her line and the way she says, I've got moves you haven't seen. Cause she tries all these different sort of tacks to entice him. And that's one of them. But I'm glad you mentioned cruel. And that's really why I think for me, in the history of all the movies that we watched over and over in our household growing up, I didn't pick this one very often because it's so cringy the whole time for me, because she is so cruel. Like the karaoke thing is a literal nightmare that I've had. So I think that's my problem with it. So I'm glad to be in this conversation and to hear from others. And it's not that I don't want her to be able to be cruel or be able to be unlikable or any of that. I just don't enjoy watching her scrambling so hard to like the lowest hanging fruit she can find. But I mean, I get it. I just, it just cringes me.
Yeah.
But you know who I enjoy?
Tell me.
Dermot Mulroney.
What? Are you serious? Okay, because that, like, if you want to talk about cruelty, that guy sucks. Like, he.
Please tell me more.
He was a horrible. Well, okay, so that's one thing that is confusing for me about this movie is that there are two women competing for the worst possible guy out there. And that's the only part that I sort of like, you know, double back on. And I'm like, wait a minute. Like, I do love a romantic comedy, but like, there is absolutely nothing appealing about him. Like, when he yells at her at the dinner table when proposes the, you know, her father's opportunity that, the job opportunity that she's offering, like his reaction to that is so over the top. And so he's a loser. Like from start to finish, he is the least appealing part of this movie.
I just need to make a distinction. Michael is a loser.
That's true.
Dermot Mulroney is a national treasure.
Well, wait a minute. Really?
Yes. And okay. We will learn more about that when it comes to the game.
Okay.
But I'm glad you brought that up. I had a note about that too, which was sort of like, what do they both see in him? And I think at least with Julia Roberts, it's all that history we've heard so much about. And that, you know, sometimes I have found that whatever, you know, time period where you were close with someone, then maybe it's a few years later, but you still like love that period or yourself at that period and them at that period. So maybe if they met today, they wouldn't be what they are, but there's so much of that time period in their lives that they were so important to each other. But I was just gonna say, I was trying to picture like the Kimmy Michael meet cute. And I couldn't. One, she's 20 years old. The ages are just painful.
Yes.
Like, as I think, you know, as Tobin's tone, speaking of reading into tones, that at when they turn 28, they're each other's backup. Terrible precedent to set for the young people of the world, I think. But that she's 20? Like, where were they? I guess at a stadium or something sportsy, but like what on earth would they have in common would be in the same place?
And on that topic of age as well. So I believe that Jules and Michael, I believe that they met sophomore year, right? Isn't that when she tells the story? So they're probably like 19 or 20.
Mm-hmm.
And right now they're 27. So there's an awful lot of history that she lays out when she's like kind of waxing poetic to George about her Michael, where it's like, wait a minute, is this like 7 years worth of friendship? That's not like a super long time.
And that they've traveled. She makes it sound like they've traveled the world together. Like in college or right after college? I don't know.
And also in this, I guess, 7-ish years, like their parents died and like they've become like they've conquered the world of, I don't know, whatever Michael's stupid job is. And she's like the world's greatest food critic. And and then again, to go back to Kimmy being 20, that is so damn young to do anything, let alone get married. So I have a lot of questions about, like, I feel like this should be a movie about people who are like 35, 36, 37. Like,
yes.
Like 20 years of friendship history is what I'm hearing her describe.
If we remade it, I think that would be important.
You age everybody up 10 years.
Yes.
And then it's and all that stuff begins to make more sense.
Yeah.
Well, and how far off do we think all of these lead actors are from the ages they're supposed to be in the movie?
Oh, that would be fun.
Ooh, that's a good
question.
Because
Kimmy was supposed to be 20, but her hair was 40.
Julia Roberts was 30.
Okay. When the movie came out. That's not far off, I guess.
No. Hang on.
I think with her, we had just already known her so long at that point.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, she was Julia Roberts. So, so in my memory, it seems like she should be older because, one, I was a child when I watched it, but also because even then it had been, you know, we owned Pretty Woman on VHS by the time this came out. So,
right. Yeah. Cameron Diaz was 25, okay. If we're still counting. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I mean, and really, I guess I've been watching this movie. I mean, it's been like 20 years that I've been watching this movie pretty regularly. I mean, I've been watching this movie as long as Kimmy was old. Like that's. And then I remember watching it, like I said, like this, like at 15, like this seemed like the model of my life. Like to come. And then I'm thinking like, oh, they're so much older than me. They're so now that I'm 10 years older than them, I'm like, wait, oh God.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm such a loser.
Before we get too much further into plotty stuff, I wanted to, and we're already actory. Can we talk about the other people? So Carrie Preston, who I love, and I forget the name of her husband.
What do you love her from? What's your touchstone with her?
For me, it's vampires.
True Blood.
Yeah.
But then also The Good Wife.
Yeah, that's mine. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I won't take yours. What's yours, Tobin?
It's The Good Wife. Thank you very much.
Oh, that's a great. That's a great one. And then she's married to the guy, one of the guys from Lost, the little bespectacled gentleman. And I just remember reading an article, you know, high journalism of People magazine, about them and their, you know, both working actors and kind of then we're both suddenly became recognizable, but for different things and we're traveling a lot. I don't know. I just liked their little world. I liked it. Mm-hmm. And then her twin in quotes.
Yeah.
In the movie is Rachel Griffiths.
Yes, it is.
What?
Well, she was in PJ Hogan's, one of his earlier movies. They're both Australian. She was in Muriel's Wedding with Toni Collette.
Yes.
So they had sort of prior, They had history.
And then Susan Sullivan.
Who's Isabel Wallace, the mother?
Isabel, the yes. And who really gets the musical number started. Because Rupert Everett starts to sing and it could be very awkward, but then she chimes in and gets the whole table going. But I mean, many, many, many things she has been in. But for me, most recently, she is Richard Castle's mother in Castle.
Oh, Castle, your jam.
I mean, Nathan Fillion is my jam.
I know.
For show. So she played a, I don't know, spirited older lady. So those are just a couple of that popped for me. But
what about Paul Giamatti?
Yes.
Oh my gosh. Giamatti. The bellhop.
Yeah.
That was a surprise. That gave me a giggle out loud.
Yeah. That still kind of surprises me every time.
Every time I see him, I'm like, oh, right, he's in this movie. Like, every time. I always forget.
Well, and what I appreciate about his very small part is that he brings some attention to the fact that they smoke cigarettes in every single room they enter in this movie.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
But it is odd. But I mean, it was odd by the standards of the late 90s to be smoking that much inside, especially watching it now. It's like, what planet is this on? But that is totally why I like Paul Giamatti's character. It's like, yeah, you guys shouldn't be smoking inside so much. It's gross.
It's also the one, speaking of the things that would change if they made the movie now.
Oh yeah. No one smokes anymore. Like it's so of the moment or of the time that the movie is made. It just feels weird.
Yeah, you can't get away with that now.
No, especially not a protagonist.
No, and not sort of America's sweetheart protagonist either. Sure. Right. Which, okay, so we need to go back and talk a little bit more about Julia Roberts, because I don't think we've given her due in this movie.
Please.
We talked about pratfalls and physical comedy, which works better for some of us in some scenes. I do love the one where she comes off the elevator and, like, you know, the tray goes, like, the entrance ones, I think, are particularly delicious. I think, is so smart to take this movie at this time as a way to sort of twist that persona, right? Like, to twist the America sweetheart to be you. I think you need someone as inherently charming and likable as she is, just as a screen presence, to get past the fact that she is doing such cruel things to the people around her. And I think that if it were played at all darker, it would be a very dark comedy. Yes. And not as much of a comedy. The other thing I think that they do so well in this is that they deploy her smile and her laughter in a way that is sort of weaponizes it. And thinking about that karaoke scene and the when she's sort of over-exaggerated laughing and doing inside jokes with Michael to keep sort of Kimmy out of the group. And she's using that, you know, her $20 million smile, like the thing that makes Julia Roberts as a movie star, but using it as like as a weapon, I think is, you know, a very smart on this movie's sort of part. Anybody else want to stand up for Julia Roberts?
Well, so I have a note that is okay. So I want to jump ahead to and sorry if you have very specific topics about this.
No,
scene.
No, not at all.
Nope.
When they are on the boat, when they go on the boat ride, and you know all of that very emotional scenery that's going on, there is this point where. And I can't even tell you what the line is, but Julia Roberts has sunglasses on and you can see her acting through the sunglasses. Like, this makes more sense in my note form, trying to like put it into words, but it grabbed me like from like my insides. I just was like, wow, she like, you could just see a shadow of her eyes behind the glasses. Yeah. And it was so incredible. So, yeah, I mean, yeah. I think from start to finish, she's A+ through this entire movie. The good, the bad, all of it. So yeah, that was my note on Julia Roberts really earning her keep.
Mm-hmm.
Totally.
That scene and the scene before it, when they're in the car at the airport, are my favorite parts. And I think the parts that maybe ring the most true, in that they're communicating about their complex feelings, that he had been jealous when she suddenly showed up with the fiance, which we as the audience know she has been this whole time, which he seems to have been oblivious to, but who knows? The levels of Dermot Mulroney, I don't want to speak for him. But when they're confronting, and then also confronting that change in their relationship, that he's going to get married tomorrow, and that, and he's excited about it, he wants to, but that is going to change who they are and what they mean to each other, and that they like for the first time and a little bit the only time are both honestly on the same page, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm, wanting to soak up what's left of this life that started, you know, all those 9 years ago with each other, and sort of honor that thing. And so that I thought was beautiful, being a person who has been very, very close to and best friends with people who have gotten married to other people. Like, that's important. And it's like it, I think in her case, right, the movie is based on her hijinks to get between them. But even if it wasn't, like, she would completely be allowed to have conflicting feelings when she gets that news, that you can be so excited for someone, but then also, yeah, you're kind of out there fantasy life, that door closes. Or he can be madly in love with Kimmy, but have a little twinge when Julianne chooses someone else. And so I appreciated so much the honesty of those couple of scenes, even though the other parts of it make me so cringy.
One of the other favorite moments that I have of hers is it's right after the Paul Giamatti scene. She's been sitting in the hallway smoking the cigarette, and then Dermot Mulroney opens the door and she falls backwards. And that's not my favorite part. I do like it, but my favorite part comes after that when we have forgotten that she's been holding on to the ring, and or at least I usually forget, and that she has tried it on, can't get it off. And then he says, "Where's the ring?" And she holds up her hand into front, like, first of all, can't quite do it. Yeah, like it gets up the courage and then kind of cries and laughs at cries and smiles at the same time, sort of demonstrate that she's got the ring still stuck on her, you know, she couldn't get it off. And in that moment, you see all of those conflicted feelings, plus kind of the shame she feels about having written the email. That's going to, like, you know, she's really crossing so many lines. Like you can sense like she has some, you know, conflicted feelings about her own behavior too in that moment, that begin to kind of like she's seeing what it's going to cost emotionally to sort of devastate these two people, and and she's not ready yet to sort of, you know, like call it off, but it's hurting her too. And I she just captures that moment so a moment that could have been played just for comedy ends up being played for all these other layers too.
Yeah, I agree. That's a very she's fantastic in this.
She's fantastic.
Movie.
Let's talk about George. I want to hear what Tony has to say about George. Both seeing direct George then and what George meant to you, and what George has, like, how you view George today.
So George is timeless. Like every move he makes, like every single thing he does is such a choice in this movie. And
yeah.
Just all of the energy and instant chemistry he has with every single person in the movie, not just Jules.
That's true. It's true.
Like, you know, like he has met all of these strangers, and like 5 minutes later, they're out to lunch and they're singing. And it's like, I feel like all of that was so completely organic. And that's mm-hmm. not just George. I mean, that's us, you know, celebrating Rupert for everything that he brought to the movie too. But yeah, I mean, for me, the thing that I think about with George most often is that completely fabulous dinner party that he's having back in New York. When she leaves that screaming voicemail and like the whole conversation just like kind of slowly grinds to a halt. that to me is like, oh, I just love this guy. And like you know, when you're that young and trying to come up with the possibilities for what your like gay life is going to look like when you finally leave mm-hmm. Virginia, like it's just, this was one of those moments where it's like, this, like, people are dressed up in my own home, and I was a little like, dirtbag smoker back then too. So I'm like, and we're smoking out cigarettes inside and wine and like, I'm sure a very clever conversation. I don't fucking know. Oh, can I use that language on your show?
Absolutely.
In
no
fact,
problem.
It's required. Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, like, I don't know. That pretty much for me, it was just like, I looked up to George. That's probably the quickest, easiest way to say it. I looked up to him. I think that's why he means so much to me.
I love that. He kind of seems to revel in every scene, right? Mm-hmm. Like when he realizes, or when he sort of, he does not know that when he shows up in Chicago, that Julianne is going to like, tell Michael that George is her fiance. And then he's like blindsided by that in the moment, and then decides to just play it. Mm-hmm. Like, you know,
well, and also a little bit to torture her too.
Oh, for sure. For
right.
Sure.
Cause he's, but I've, what a great kind of, not revenge is too strong of a word, but like she's put him in a really yes. awkward position. And so he knows her well enough to know what he can do to support, like he yes ands her, but like in a way that's going to push
right, exactly.
all of her buttons.
Yeah, well, he yes ands her in like, you want this to be, yeah. Go ahead.
I think Rupert makes great choices, but I love all the choices that George makes in that thing, right? Because she said, like, she says something about like tone it down or whatever, and then he immediately makes the sex joke to Kimmy's parents, and you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, he just goes for it, and then
conjugal visit. Yes,
I always remember, like, when he says yes to lunch, he says, love it. Love the bag, love the shoes, yes. Love everything, love it.
Yes, yes.
I think of that line so often in my life.
He's so quotable. Like, he is a completely, yes. Yeah. Every line he's got is like, oh, that's a quote that I will use for the next 100 years.
Yeah. And then he gives her, when he's, you know, okay, so because I already said it's my two favorite scenes, but I'll add him to the beginning of it at the airport. She asks him what to do, and he tells her,
yeah,
that she right. already knows is the right thing to do, but the right thing to do. And then, and she's so great in this too, when she's torn up what's going to happen. And he's like, he's going to marry her because he loves her, and you're going to go on with your life. Like,
yeah,
just right. get, you know, not get over it, but just get through it is what I sort of hear from him there. And so even with all the hijinks we've said like 17 times, if you're using this podcast as a drinking game, please make wise choices. We've said hijinks too many times, but with all his heightened frivolity, he's still at the heart of it, her rock and her support in this. And he's going to tell her the truth, even if she's not able to, you know, tell it to herself yet, which is also why you take that and then add to those two other scenes. And that to me is the part that I think is so special.
What great instincts they had to see what they had in Rupert Everett as George and what the potential was in the George and Julianne relationship, whatever combination of them that was, what, you know, including Julie Roberts and Rupert Everett and the director and the writer, that they then sort of weren't afraid to kind of restructure their movie, because that becomes, I think that helps it. If George is her friend, and this is George, then I know she's not a deeply terrible person, even if she's doing terrible things, right? There must be something redeeming about her, because this man is her friend and cares about her and, you know, clearly enjoys spending time with her, even if he's like, you are being a terrible person right now. And as a person, as someone who in her life who's able to say that, and I think it does something to, I don't want to say redeem her character, because that makes it, that's a really loaded term, but at least it sort of helps shade her as a character in ways that I really sort of helps sort of leaven the venom in some of the rest of the things that she does in this movie.
So something that I was trying to track in this, and I don't have a definitive answer, so that's the question part of it. There's a lot made at the beginning. Not at the very beginning, but in the early interactions between Kimmy and Julianne about her lack of kind of traditional views on romance and marriage and love and that because the way that Michael has described her, she's eschewing all those things to do something else and blah, blah. And then toward the end, she makes more comments about it and that, you know, wasn't her focus or whatever. And so I don't know. That was part of the cringy for me, in that I felt like in moments, the movie was penalizing her for that. Mm. Like, and I know it subverts things and, you know, there are good nuggets in here, but the way at least it's framed in that first kind of half, I read it at times to be she's missing out on this, whatever this is, because of her, whether it's temperament or views or whatever. And so this is what she doesn't get because she can't say the word love or whatever. And so that, I don't know, but I haven't studied it as you two have. So what do you make of that thought?
Tony, you want to crack at that?
Yeah. So That is not what I was expecting you to say. I feel like I need a minute because I didn't really see it that way.
And you don't have to.
But now that you're pointing it out, I think it makes a lot of sense. I think that's why I need a minute because I'm like, that is a really valid perspective on what she was going through and like some of her life decisions and what had gotten her to the point that she was at now and then where she was when they were in that original relationship, which is where I was assuming Michael was referencing the things that he had told Kimmy about her. I don't know. I don't know what to say.
I think that in that moment, that really makes a lot of sense. I think that in the arc of the whole movie, if the movie had, and I know you're not saying the movie fully comes down on that side of sort of penalizing her for that or sort of making a moral judgment about what path is better, the more traditional, we get married at 20 and drop out of college. but I think that if the movie was more conservative in its outlook that way, she would have, along the journey of the movie, met somebody else.
Sure. That's a good point.
You know, like that she would have been rewarded for her good behavior, for coming in line with the value system of the movie by having romance with a dude. Mm-hmm. And I think what's interesting, so the way I read that scene, and maybe it's just that it's not, it's not maybe as clear as it needs to be in that scene, is that she's just not, that there's an openness that she has not had or experienced or chosen, not an openness necessarily to romantic love, but an openness to intimacy that she, you know, the kind of intimacy of even of sort of recognizing what her relationship with Michael is and is going to be and letting go of what she thought it was going to be and all that kind of stuff, that she's breaking past a point in her life where she had him as a placeholder, right? Like he's the backup.
Right.
And so I always have this placeholder and I don't need to sort of really commit to anything or anyone in any kind of way. And then just she realizes that, you know what, George and I are kind of like, we are intimate in a kind of different way. Right. But you're right. That moment does feel like, oh, a little bit icky. Like, what are we?
Well, when you add that to the very opening scene where she is describing the relationship she had with Michael to George. And when she says we had one hot month and George chimes in that's something he's heard before. And he even says something like, oh, same old Jules. Like they set her up as someone who, and I don't know, not necessarily fear of commitment or a lack of interest, or like her interest wanders or whatever it is that she's not able to, you know, stay in one place in a relationship. I don't know. It just, I just wonder what would be different, you know, maybe 20 years later into it. Also, I still don't fully understand why does Kimmy need to /choose to quit school because Michael travels so much for his job.
I guess. And because she's a billionaire, I guess.
There are so many questions in this movie that are answered by the fact that her family is insanely wealthy.
Sure.
Like, right. How did they put a wedding together in such a short amount of time? Well, because they have money. Like, just every question that I had, I was like, oh, right. These aren't problems for wealthy people, which is a bit off topic. But, like, yeah, I kind of wondered about that, too, when it was like, so you're going to travel with your husband, you know, full time, so you can't go to school anymore. Who travels with their spouse for work? Like, and that frequently, that would be very weird. That would be a strange situation. So yeah, for her to drop out of school to be with the man that she loves, because she's already, you know, she's already seen the world at 20. I can't think of an opportunity where I would bring Joe with me on one of my business trips, let alone every single one of them.
It would be different, too. Like, for instance, my understanding of the relationship between famous attorney Tom Girardi and his wife, Erica Girardi, or Erica Jane, as her alter ego, is that for the first 10 years of their relationship, she flew everywhere with him and she was his, you know, companion in all things. But he's like has this hugely ridiculous career. Whereas over and over again, they've said Michael's job is shitty, but he loves it.
What is his job? I'm not totally clear.
He's a sports writer. I understood as they were both journalists.
Right, right.
Like, and that's how they were in the same place in college. She is a food critic. He's a sports writer.
Yeah, I mean, I may have seen this movie 1,000 times, but I clearly zone out when Michael
is just fast forward to George.
It's the George supercut version of the movie.
Like Michael, sports, whatever.
Moving on. I mean, really. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
So in the real world, they should not be getting married yet, right? Like, I mean, I don't want to judge anybody's choices, but like at 20, as we've said, like, you know, Kimmy should maybe take a little time and they can like, I don't know, date for a while. Like, you know, she can come on some of the trips when she's on spring break or whatever. Like, I feel like there is a that's part of the movie that still to me or that I think always has kind of made me feel a little squicked out. Like, I believe that they're in love and that's great, but there are also practical concerns and I feel like she could just take a little more time. I think that would be. I don't think that would be a problem for anybody, really.
Yeah. Or if it's that big a deal for her family to be married, then that could have been part of it. But now we're just rewriting the film. So what was the original ending?
Oh, man. I've got to check this now.
Okay. You don't have to. I was just trying to.
It was. I know the actor's name, but I'm just blanking on it. That actor that was in My Big Fat Greek Wedding and John Sex Corbett? And the City.
Yeah.
So at the end of the reception, at the end of the wedding, Julie Roberts goes off, you know, and is, I guess, sitting, you know, outside of the tent having a quiet moment alone. And John Corbett walks by and they have, you know, sort of, and he like turns around and comes back and they have like a, you know, a meet cute right there at the end. So she lives happily ever after with
John Corbett,
or whatever,
which feels like in Tony's scale feels like a swap, like an equal swap for Dermot Mulroney.
I also love John Corbett. Just for the record, I think other than Joe, it seems like Tony and I don't have the same taste.
Your Venn diagram is very small. Yeah, that is I think that would be a terrible ending to this movie.
I think agree.
It would be terrible. Yeah, I don't know. Especially for everything that she has put people through, and which is not to say that she has to be like punished for that, but to, you know, to have the reward for romantic comedy once again to be, you know, romance is a one of the things I find refreshing about this movie is that it doesn't sort of adhere to that.
Yeah, I agree. I think refreshing is a great way to describe the God, that took me too long to get to that word. Refreshing is a great way to describe how this movie wraps up.
Yeah. Yeah. Even though we're at the end, can we talk about the opening credits sequence a little bit?
Yes, because you lied to me.
Oh, okay.
What?
Here's my memory. My memory is that you told me that Liz Phair was singing.
No, it's Ani DiFranco. Oh.
Okay. Sorry. Then my memory is you told me Liz Phair, but we'll put Ani DiFranco in there. But that's not who is.
No, it's not. Oh, yeah. It's not the actor.
So I remember you telling me like that it was cool and subversive because it was this alt feminist, whatever, singing this song, like sarcastically.
Well,
but then the way it's presented is very straightforward. So I was confused. So tell me now for real, because my memory is clearly incorrect.
Well, Noah, Ana DiFranco talks about how the irony of being chosen and getting to sing that song at the opening of this movie with these sort of, you know, candy coated backgrounds, and like that there's it is meant to be ironic. There is irony involved, but it's only irony in that if you know like who's singing it, right? Like there's
right.
Or the fact that it is just a little over the top, and you know, and she was, the director wanted her to play the bride. This all comes from an LA Times story. Like wanted her to be in the thing with her. At the time she had like spiky blue hair and stuff, and like she was supposed to be and I think that would have been better. I think it would have been cooler. But I do love the kind of, I don't know, the kind of kitschy pantomimey quality to the thing, which is, I think, in contrast to Jules in the movie, I think kind of works. At the time I was shortly afterwards in college when I was watching this movie, I was an Ana DiFranco fan. And so I don't know. I've always kind of liked that bit.
That must have been where it came from. I apologize for remembering it as Liz Phair.
I think that's fair. Sorry.
Of all the times that I have watched this movie, I would have to say at least 20 of them, like when I was much younger and before we had YouTube, I would put the movie in only to watch the beginning, to watch the opening sequence, and then settle in for the rest almost every time. And also every time I watched it, I would watch the opening credits 2-3 times. I love the opening credits. And I know that I said earlier that I don't like theater. But
I believe you said you hate the occasional
the occasional musical does creep into my soul. And this is maybe off topic a little bit, but I read this one article about this movie referring to My Best Friend's Wedding as a backdoor musical.
Ooh,
which
sure,
because it kicks off with the opening credits. Then there's another musical scene at the karaoke bar. Then obviously the climactic musical scene at the restaurant. Then Michael sings on the boat and they dance. And then the reception has a whole other, you know, crop of musical moments. And then the very random three boys singing on the tennis court.
Yes.
So that is give or take 6 musical numbers in this movie. Some more subtle than others, but essentially this is not far from a musical. And I believe it's being adapted for Broadway.
Has to be.
I feel like I've read that. Although that was a long time ago. I feel like by now we would have heard something. But either way, most of the work's already done. Yeah. It's a Burt Bacharach musical.
Yeah. There you go.
And this is also the movie. I mean, this movie is why I love Dionne Warwick. That's probably pretty shameful.
Dionne comes off really well in this movie.
Yes. Yeah. So this movie got me into Dionne Warwick.
I had never thought about it as a musical in that way, but you're so right. Like I could also teach this in the history of musicals too, for that matter.
Why not?
Oh, that's great.
So yeah, so the opening credits, that really, you know, that kicks it off. But that's one of my absolute favorite parts of this whole thing.
One of the things I love about watching this movie now is to see a big movie star studio comedy, original studio comedy, with that sort of understands the strengths of its actors, but allows them to kind of, in Rupert Everett's case, kind of, you know, he is defined by this role then, right? Like a career defining thing. And for Julia Roberts to put a spin on it, and for Cameron Diaz to, you know, have another breakout. Like the writer Ron Bass has talked about how this movie couldn't get made anymore. Like no one, you know, if you did, you'd make it, it would be an indie movie and you would have not the biggest star in the world. You'd have somebody from TV or, you know, which is not to say it would be bad, but it wouldn't be, people wouldn't go to the movie theater in the numbers that you would need to have this to make this kind of movie today. So there is something kind of, you know, like a time capsule-y about it, or, you know, it sort of had to kind of happen at that moment. And I, when you see the stars align, pun intended, for a movie like this, and for especially Julia Roberts, an actor that I love so often, but then that other times is so disserved by roles that she gets. Someday we'll talk about Erin Brockovich. I keep saying that on this show, but I.
Yeah, I just talked about Tom Girardi.
Yes.
Who is the real life lawyer.
Right.
Any time that I can talk about Erica Jane Tobin, I am ready. So let's cue that up.
Okay. Well, in any case, I to see her sort of given material, all these characters to give given material that allows them to kind of stretch and play real characters and be, you know, bring make me messed up and laugh. And for all the other parts of the movie that aren't, that don't work like that, I don't think this is a masterpiece of a movie, but I think it is a sort of a real high watermark of studio American studio romantic comedies.
Was this a box office success? I don't know any of that information.
I will double check the numbers here.
I mean, Julia Roberts in the 90s, I'm assuming it was. I just, yeah, I was kind of wondering why there isn't a sequel.
That's a great point. This movie was...
That would be the other point if it was made today.
It would have to be a franchise. Yeah. So the movie was made for $38 million, which is a tiny budget in today's sort of money, but was a sort of, you know, a healthy studio budget in 1997. The domestic gross was $127 million. And in worldwide, it made just under $300 million. So, so they did, it did very well.
Okay. All right.
It is. I mean, if was Runaway Bride a direct sequel to, no, it's just them together again, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Right. And we don't get, Julia Roberts and Dermot Mulroney again before Homecoming? They're the Hulu show.
I don't believe so, but you're inching closer to the game.
Is part of the game the fact that she suggested him for this role? Okay. Well, no, she suggested him for this role. Sorry, Tony.
That's fine. He's very bland and dull, and I can look right past him. So I agree with the casting.
Well, and you know, I wonder if part of that doesn't work to the movie's advantage that...
Right, because it's not about him.
Oh, not at all. Yeah,
and that by having an actor who kind of blends into the furniture a little bit is actually maybe because then the movie becomes so much more about Jules and Kimmy and Jules and George and if not by design, I think that does work for the movie.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. That works.
You can still fast forward through his parts.
Well,
yeah.
Well, and I feel like the sequel idea would have been a romantic storyline for George with Jules as the support, taking place in New York. So just sort of flip the romance and just continue. Because the real love of this story is obviously George and Jules. So give us a sequel. Let's see this whole thing. Let's see them interact some more.
They could make that today.
I'd be fine with that.
That'd be great. I think it'd be great. Yeah.
And with all that updated technology too, so no more 6-inch thick laptops or faxes
or giant
from your
cell phones.
Giant cell phones, yes.
And answering machines.
Yeah, although then you'd miss that scene in George's house.
Oh, that's true.
Oh shoot. We'll have to figure it out some other way. Well, in the meantime, while y'all work on that script, would you like to play a game?
Yes, sure. Please.
Okay. This game is stolen. It is stolen directly from the podcast Doug Loves Movies. But the content I have updated for our purposes here. The game is called Dermot McDermott. And we will alternate. I'm writing. Oh no, it's Tobin and Tony. I'm gonna say Addington and DeFrank. We'll alternate who goes first. I will give you a movie title and a year.
Okay.
And then you will tell me, did Dylan McDermott, Dermot Mulroney, or neither appear in the film?
Okay. Okay.
No Googling.
Okay.
Sit on your hands. Right? Because there's a joke that Dylan McDermott and Dermot Mulroney are the same person.
Right. Right. Yeah. That's great.
So, Tony, since you are a guest, you will begin.
Okay.
If you get it correct, you get 2 points. If you do not, Tobin will have a chance to answer because there are still two options left.
Okay.
And can get 1 point. And then we'll switch and Tobin will go first.
Are you keeping track of points or am I supposed to?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Okay. So, Tony.
Yes.
Steel Magnolias, 1989. Dylan McDermott, Dermot Mulroney, or neither?
Dylan McDermott.
Correct.
Wow. I would not have gotten that.
Tobin.
Yes. Yes.
Jersey Girl from 1992. Dylan McDermott, Dermot Mulroney, or neither?
Dermot Mulroney.
That is incorrect. Tony for the steal.
I've not seen it, but I'm going to say neither.
Incorrect. Dylan McDermott and Gene Triplehorn.
Really?
Yes.
I mean, I
look it up later, not right now.
I trust you. I trust you.
Sorry. So that was Tobin. So, Tony, Reality Bites, 1994. Dylan McDermott, Dermot Mulroney, or neither?
Reality Bites was only 3 years before this movie.
Correct.
God, the 90s were weird.
Oh my gosh. I think it's Dylan.
Incorrect. Tobin for the steal?
Neither.
Correct. 1 point for Tobin.
I had no idea. I don't think I've ever seen Reality Bites.
I apologize. When I said Gene Triplehorn, I meant Jamie Gertz.
I don't know who that is.
Okay. But if any...
I know who Gene Triplehorn is.
Anyone older than us will... Jason Mantzoukas would have been upset with that. Okay. Tobin, it's yes. To you.
Okay.
Bad Girls, 1994.
Huh. Oh, Dylan McDermott.
I'm sorry, that is incorrect.
Oh, man. Danny?
Is Bad Girls the one with Drew Barrymore and Madeline Kahn?
It is. It's Old Westy.
Oh, I don't remember any men being in that movie. neither.
I'm sorry, that's incorrect. Dermot Mulroney. Really? But that makes sense to me if you don't remember him and things.
Yeah, that's true. It makes this game really tough for Tony.
I loved him in that film.
I remember the like VHS box of that movie at Finke's where we rented our movies.
I do too. And that's where we rented it and watched it. And then I rented it several more times after that. Okay.
For Dermot Mulroney.
We're still only in the mid-90s, folks. Yes, okay. For Dermot Mulroney. Tony.
Ready.
An Island Addington favorite. How to Make an American Quilt, 1995.
What?
Dylan McDermott, Dermot Mulroney, or neither? It's Winona Ryder.
Dylan McDermott.
I'm sorry, that is incorrect.
Oh my gosh.
Tobin?
Dermot Mulroney.
Yes.
That's one that you own, and now I'm assuming that's why you own it.
Yes, it's one of the reasons. He plays her boyfriend. She cheats on him with Jonathan Scheck from That Thing You Do.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Okay, Tobin.
Okay.
Also 1997, same year as this movie.
Ooh.
Till There Was You. That's Gene Triplehorn.
Oh, that title is familiar. I'm going to say neither.
That is incorrect. Tony?
I'm just going to always guess Dylan McDermott.
You are correct.
Oh, man.
Okay, Tony, we're reaching toward the millennium. 1999's Never Been Kissed. Dylan McDermott, Dermot Mulroney, or neither?
I mean, the romantic lead in that, I was going to say Michael Vaughn, but that was his name on Alias. I'm going to say neither.
Correct.
Okay. Ooh, man.
Kicking your ass, here. Tobin.
Yeah.
Okay, Tobin.
Yeah.
2004's Collateral. Dylan McDermott, Dermot Mulroney, or neither. Oh,
Collateral's a movie I do know. I'm going to say neither.
Correct.
Oh, thank goodness.
All right.
Mark Ruffalo's closer. In that movie. Peter Berger's in that movie. Javier Bardem is in that movie. Lots of people in that movie.
It was a good one for me to put in there. Eh?
Yeah. Because then it had me really like wondering.
Tony, the 2007 The Messengers. Dylan McDermott, Dermot Mulroney, or neither.
I don't know what that is. Neither?
Neither do I.
Neither is incorrect. Tobin for the steal.
It's called The Messengers?
Yes. It looks to be a thriller or horror film.
Dermot Mulroney.
Incorrect.
Oh, man.
Dylan McDermott. Kristen Stewart. And then someone else famous, I forget. Okay, we're almost done. But we have some of my favorites coming up. Tobin.
Yes.
The kind of fraught and rumor-ridden Georgia Rule from 2007.
Oh, Dermot Mulroney.
Correct.
Yep.
Is that Lindsay Lohan?
It is Lindsay Lohan and Jane Fonda.
Right.
And Felicity Huffman.
Oh, felon.
Yes, felon. Yeah, two out of three are there, although they've all been arrested.
That's true. Yeah.
Tony, The Lincoln Lawyer. 2011.
McConaughey.
Oh my God. Some of these movies sound so dull. So I'm going to have to guess Dermot Mulroney.
Incorrect. Tobin for the steal?
This is Dylan McDermott.
This is neither.
Oh, man.
But wouldn't you think Matthew McConaughey would be in a movie with one of those two?
Yeah, and Ryan Phillippe's in that movie, too. That feels like a Dermot Mulroney kind of...
All right. We're getting down to... we just have to keep going because one of my favorite movies is still on the list. Tobin.
Yeah.
The Gray, 2011.
Oh, okay. I've not seen this movie. This is
Liam Neeson vehicle.
Yeah, this is Michael Carnahan or Matthew McConaughey. Carnahan. I'm going to say it's Dylan McDermott.
Incorrect. Tony?
Neither.
Incorrect. It's Dermot Mulroney is in The Gray.
Does he play one of the wolves?
Yes. All right, Tony, this is another important one for you.
Okay.
The adaptation of my favorite book of all time. The Perks of Being a Wallflower, 2012.
Dylan McDermott.
Correct.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he plays the dad.
Oh, wow.
So for any of my students listening, I will be teaching a course on The Perks of Being a Wallflower in spring 2020. Join me.
Sign up now.
Line up now. And then finally, the last one, Tobin starts.
Mm.
The 2016 romp, Dirty Grandpa.
Oh, God. Oh, this is the Zac Efron movie?
Mm-hmm.
And, okay, so I have no idea. I'm going to say neither.
Incorrect. Huh. Which means... being a point ahead already, Tony, you've won it. Would you like to take a guess just to see if you can get that extra point for pride?
Yeah, I'm going to stick with Dylan McDermott.
That is incorrect. Of course, the grand finale is a Mulroney.
But, you know, I suspected that might be the case.
Tony, you have won 7 points.
Wow.
7-6.
I had six
great
points.
Work,
how did
both
I have
of you?
6 points?
You had some steals in there.
Oh man.
Stolen moments. Thank you all for
good game. Well played.
Well, speaking of fun, now is the point in our podcast where we decide if this movie is progressive or regressive and share our closing thoughts. Is this movie a step forward or a step back for fearless women in front of and behind the camera? Tony, what say you?
Overall, I think I would call this progressive. I have a real connection to any romantic comedy where in the end, she doesn't get the guy. Like, I feel like that is an option for all of us. So I feel like that is something that's not often celebrated in the romantic comedy genre, that at the end, we're okay being, you know, our own full self. So because this movie has an ending where she remains single and, you know, continues to live her amazing life without the horrible guy, I'd call it progressive.
Excellent. Aizam, what about you?
While I agree with Tony's points, and I feel like, Tobin, before we played the game, you had a nice wrap-up about why this movie is important in terms of romantic comedies, I just don't see it moving the needle for me. And part of that is there was not much of note behind the camera that we talked about. But I agree it pushes some boundaries and I like the way it does that, but it's just not enough with, you know, she's 20 and they're going to quit school and she has problems talking about love. And I don't know, it didn't do enough for me to stamp it progressive. So I'm going to stand in the middle.
All right, the middle. I'm going to agree with Tony. I think that in addition to that, the ending, which you so eloquently described, I think that the movie is progressive in how cruel it allows Jules to be, in how far she will go to do this thing. And the idea of a romantic comedy made by a studio in the history of romantic comedies where the goal is not to, really the goal isn't as much to get the guy as it is to break up the wedding, I think is that there's a subversive quality to that I think is a step forward, if perhaps it's not replicable or just wasn't replicated in kind of interesting ways, or and despite all its other flaws, I do think that for that reason and for the way the movie ends, that it is a step forward. Maybe a small step, but a step forward. Heisland, speaking of steps, I have no segue. What are we going to talk about next?
Are we going to talk about what you said we're going to talk about?
Do you want to do Booksmart instead?
We can.
Should we put that next?
Yeah.
Okay, let me put that in here then. Yep.
Okay. Thank you. Coming up next.
What are we going to talk about next?
Okay. Next up, please join us July 9th for 2019's Booksmart.
I'm very excited. That's going to be fun.
I'm excited too.
Yeah.
Tony, thank you so much for joining us today and having this conversation with us. I forgive you for marrying Joe. And if you would like to be found, I'm going to do that one again. Where would you? One more time. I got flustered because I started thinking about Joe. Where can folks find you if you want to be found?
They can find me in Portland on my couch watching this movie again.
Excellent. But only the opening credits.
Only the opening credits. I can't be found anywhere.
I respect that. Tobin, how about you?
People can find me on Twitter @Tobin Addington. And probably if they want to, they can tweet at us to say how much they enjoyed Tony on the show, or at Joe. listen to his previous episodes on the podcast and tweet about how much you like both of them.
Excellent. I am, as always, reluctantly on Twitter at SassyNerdMT. If you've enjoyed the sound of my voice, you could also check out my other podcast, Why Aren't We All?, where I have short conversations with folks who have a belief or practice that helps them get through this difficult time we're in right now. My last episode that came out at the beginning of June was about why aren't we all enjoying beer? And the next episode coming out in July will be a topic a little more universally healthy. So stay tuned for it.
A little tease there.
Mm-hmm. Ooh. Just a little. And you can find us on Twitter, as Tobin mentioned, at contenders_pod, or on Patreon at thecontenderspod.com. Special thanks to our members who've joined at the marquee level or above, celebrity Sean Flynn, and arguably also celebrity Jeff Addington.
Celebrity to us, anyway. And to our listeners. We here at The Contenders are proud members of the Cage Club Podcast Network. You can explore all their great shows at cageclub.me, and you can keep tabs on all the Cage Club happenings on Twitter at Cage Club Pod. As always, thank you so much for listening. I am Tobin Addington.
I'm Tony DeFrank.
I am Aislinn Addington, and we'll see you next time on The Contenders. I have another comment and question about her character.
Okay.
Which I will now share.
No, I am not a fan of the Tonys in general.
Interesting.
Yeah, hot take.
I was going to say hot take, but I want to be. Okay.
Does that have anything to do with your name being Tony? I mean, because I feel like if there was something called the Tobins, I'd be like, no, I'm not watching the fucking Tobins.
No, it's because I hate theater.
I love that you're married to Joe. I think that's amazing.
All right. We better start because we're already having too much fun.
Okay.
And I don't want any more of this to not make it in the episode.